If you want a vision of the future, Winston, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Someone is trying to teach me a lesson in futility. Why am I the only one who isn't killed?
They will run you dizzy. They will pile falsehood on top of falsehood until you can't tell a lie from the truth and you won't even want to. That's how the powerful keep their power. Don't you read the papers?
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, sir, yeah.
Plastics.
I'm going to get your money for you. But if you don't get the President of the United States on that phone, you know what's going to happen to you?
What?
You're going to have to answer to the Coca-Cola company.
The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business, Mr. Beale. It has been since man crawled out of the slime.
Welcome to an episode of Our Interesting Times. It's my pleasure to have Michael Jones back on the show. Of course, he is the author of several books, The Jewish Revolutionary Spirit and Its Impact on World History, The Slaughter of Cities, Urban Renewal as Ethnic Cleansing, Barren Metal, A History of Capitalism as the Conflict Between Labor and Usury. The most recent, The Broken Pump in Tanzania, Julius Nyerere and the Collapse of Development Economics. And, of course, he is the editor of Culture Wars magazine. And tonight, Dr. Jones, I have invited you back on to discuss a book you wrote a while back in the mid-1990s, John Cardinal Kroll and the Culture Revolution. Although it's more than 20 years old, it's more relevant than ever. So this book, what inspired you to write it? And let's talk about it.
Okay. This was around the late 1980s, early 1990s, I read a biography of Cardinal Bernardin by Eugene Kennedy, a former Maryknoll priest, and I was singularly unimpressed. And I began to think that I grew up in Philadelphia during a very turbulent period in that city's history, and no one had ever written a biography of Cardinal Kroll. So at that point, I had a contact in Rome, Monsignor Thomas Herron. I had met him in Rome. He had taken me on a tour down under the Scavi at St. Peter's. And I proposed the idea to him. And the way the church works is if a trusted cleric recommends something, you do it. And Cardinal Kroll was a genius, both in finances and as an administrator. He knew how to say yes, and he knew how to say no. And he said yes to the book, to the project. So what he did was open up the archives of the Archdiocese of Philadelphia to me. Now, this was 100 cubic feet of documents that no one had ever seen before, other than the people who signed or wrote the documents themselves. And so the first order of business was to hire a nun to go through and catalog all of these documents, which she did, and then I began to realize I had an insight into primary documents that would allow me to tell the real story of the 1960s. And the real story of the 1960s did involve the Catholic Church. There was no question about it. The war on the Catholic Church had begun in earnest after World War II. And the opening salvo was probably Paul Blanchard's series of articles in the Nation magazine, a left-wing magazine, which culminated in a book called American Freedom and Catholic Power, in which he portrayed the Catholic Church as a threat to everything Americans stood for, everything. And the book was wildly popular, and the entire WASP establishment endorsed what virtually every Catholic thought was the rebirth of nativism and anti-Catholic bigotry in polite attire. People like McGeorge Bundy, Perry Miller, the scholar on Puritanism, they endorsed it. They said it was just a great book. Over the period of the 1950s, this war accelerated on two fronts, basically. The urban renewal front, which I covered in Slaughter of Cities, basically the systematic destruction of Catholic neighborhoods, and also the psychological warfare front, which was the sexual revolution, trying to influence the sexual behavior of Catholics, largely by getting them to choose birth control. But it was also the time of the Hollywood decided that the Jews in Hollywood said they'd had enough of the production code. They didn't want Catholics telling them what films to make. And so that battle was brewing all along. And all of it sort of came together in the 1960s. And that was the period when Kroll became Cardinal Archbishop of Philadelphia. And that was the material that I had at hand. It's just a question of spending a couple of years going through the archives and then summarizing and writing the book. That's the book, John Cardinal Kroll and the Cultural Revolution.
So that was in February 61. That wasn't too long after the John F. Kennedy assumed the presidency.
Yes.
Yeah. And you talk about Catholic. You talk about Catholic power. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
In many ways, the culmination of that came on July 4th, 1962, in Philadelphia Independence Hall, where you had a Catholic president, Catholic governor of the state of Pennsylvania, and a Catholic mayor of Philadelphia all sitting on the same platform. It was kind of like Paul Blanchard's worst nightmare came true in Philadelphia.
Yes, but I guess the enemies of the church weren't standing still or staying. They were planning behind the scenes because they took notice of this. Yeah, it's John F. Kennedy, Governor David Lawrence, and John Tate, the mayor of Philadelphia. Now this is called sort of the Catholic.
James Tate.
This is called the Catholic High Watermark. But the same time, this also was the high watermark of Americanism, which was ultimately the church's undoing, correct?
Yeah, I think that, well, the key to that was the anti-communist crusade, mm-hmm. which basically anesthetized the brain of the Catholic Church in America. Everybody knew communism was bad. Kroll was a Pole. He knew what had happened in Poland after the war, and so he was fully on board with the anti-communist crusade, which reached its culmination during the just after Reagan stepped down when George H.W. Bush was president and the Berlin Wall fell and communism collapsed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course.
So the Catholic Church was on board with the anti-communist crusade.
Yeah, and that's this. Of course, David Wemhoff writes about this in his book. John Courtney Murray, on his book on John Courtney Murray, Time, Life, and the American Proposition, the doctrinal warfare. And it was a well thought out, well devised right. plan, beginning in the late 40s, but really carrying in through the 50s and 60s, and involving a vast array of foundations, universities, media, Time, Life, and these things. It's stunning.
Right.
But yeah, and you talk, of course, Cardinal Kroll, a Pole, ethnic Pole, of course. The best example of sort of this undermining of the Catholic Church by the Cold War was, the papacy of John Paul II. A similar problem, you would say, right? Where he,
yeah. So Kroll was an American patriot at the time, probably at the period where the Catholic Church reached its greatest expansion point in Philadelphia. And there was war going on, and he just simply could not recognize it. He could not recognize it for what it was. I mentioned specifically, I think there's a chapter on Most Blessed Sacrament Parish in there. Mm-hmm. And this was a small area. It was 8 blocks by 8 blocks, city blocks, but it was very densely populated because it was row houses, and you basically had 120 houses on a block. So you had a lot of people. They had so many people there, big Irish Catholic families, that they could send their own representative to the legislature in Harrisburg. And this man was a devout Catholic, and he became, over this period of time, public enemy number one among the liberal elite, the WASP. It was kind of like this weird combination. It was the ADA, Americans for Democratic Action, so it was kind of like a weird combination of Episcopalians, Quakers, and Jews, which made up the ruling class elite in Philadelphia. And during this period of time, they were committed to the government sponsorship of birth control. And Martin Mullen, the state senator who had been elected from Most Blessed Sacrament Parish, was head of the finance committee, and he held up the entire bill. In other words, hold up the budget. We're not going to pass the budget until you remove these the funding for birth control. Well, this caused outrage among all decent people in Philadelphia. I mean, you know, decent thinking people didn't do this kind of stuff. And everybody hated him. And they would write articles about him. No pretense of fairness whatsoever when it came to Martin Mullen. The Philadelphia Inquirer and the Bulletin just tore into this guy in the most outrageous violation of journalistic ethics you have ever seen in your life, you know, because he was public enemy number one. That's why Most Blessed Sacrament was targeted. And so beginning in 1966, the vehicle for the destruction of MBS was black migration. Over this period of time, black people from North Carolina, largely under the management of a black minister by the name of Leon Sullivan, who was collaborating with the Ford Foundation, basically brought busloads and trainloads of black people up from North Carolina and started putting them into neighborhoods like Southwest Philadelphia MBS Parish. And over the period of from 1966 until 1976, the entire neighborhood was ethnically cleansed. All the Irish were driven out, and it became a black neighborhood composed of people who did not go to Catholic Church, didn't go to Catholic Church. They would send their kids to the Catholic school, but they did not become Catholics. So I brought this to Cardinal Kroll's attention. He was alive when I got started the research. I was in his office, and I said, let's assume you're the head of the De Beers diamond mine in South Africa, and suddenly someone starts pumping it full of water. What would you do? And I said, this is exactly what happened at MBS. This parish provided more vocations than any other parish in the archdiocese. And over this period of time, it was destroyed. Now, didn't you know what was happening? And he said to me, you can't tell people where to live. So basically, the misfortune here, from an administrative point of view, is that the Archdiocese of Philadelphia includes not only city parishes, but suburban parishes as well. Mm-hmm. It includes basically the entire suburban area of Philadelphia, which meant that it didn't matter really if the Irish were ethnically cleansed in Southwest Philadelphia, because they ended up in Delaware County. So you didn't really lose anybody. You know, they just moved. It was like moving from one place in the archdiocese to another. I think that was a mistake. That's the way he perceived it.
He's not seeing the importance of demographics, and the idea of concentrating in a small area of an ethnic group, and then them having this strong Catholic, Irish Catholic identity, and the political force that grows from that, not just in the Catholic Church, but also in the legislature, and holding back, their enemies in the culture war. But he seems to fail to recognize that there was a culture war at the time, though there was this sort of organized malevolence that was targeting the church. Because he sees
he had no idea whatsoever.
Yeah, because he's saying he's taking a laissez-faire approach. He's saying this, all this is happening just by, coincidence.
I personally think he could not conceive of the fact that agents associated with the United States government were trying to destroy the Catholic Church.
Well, in his defense, you had not written Slaughter of Cities yet.
That's right. And I could not have written the Slaughter of Cities until I had written the John Cardinal Crowe and the Cultural Revolution. You're absolutely right. I had to figure it out on my own.
Yeah, I can understand why he would miss that. And quite frankly, I didn't really grasp until I read your book. So,
Right. So my wife was a teacher in Southwest Philadelphia during this period of time. And one of her students' brother was murdered on the streets in gang warfare. Now, the Philadelphia Inquirer would write about the white gang. It was called the Dirty Annies. But there was mysteriously no black gangs in Southwest Philadelphia. So how did this guy, his family had just moved from Ireland. He didn't know he was white. He showed up at the wrong place at the wrong time and he got killed. But who killed him? Well, there are no black gangs. They were never identified. Right? So it was completely one-sided, a one-sided description of what was going on. And the whole problem was white racism in Southwest Philadelphia. That was the beginning, middle, and end of that story. There was no other story.
And you've recounted, I think, in a couple of your interviews where this strategy is revealed, where you knew someone who was a Catholic but worked in a law firm that was, I guess, Quaker or Protestant, and they admitted this using black migration and integration to destroy the Catholic power in Philadelphia?
Right, right. Yeah, he was like the classic WASP. He went to Penn Charter, and then he went to Yale. And then he came back and got a job with the big prestigious WASP law firm. And he still had the WASP name. His name wasn't, Fabian Bruskowitz or something like that. It was a real WASP name. And the head of the firm, I think they were out somewhere talking, and probably a few drinks. And he said that, basically, we created Wilson Good. And we created Wilson Good as he was the first black mayor of Philadelphia because we didn't want Philadelphia to fall into the hands of the Catholics. Robbins didn't realize that my friend had just had converted to Catholicism. Mm-hmm. So they admitted that. And then Wilson Good's most famous act in Philadelphia was burning down 8 city square blocks when he dropped a bomb on the MOVE insurgency. Also in Southwest Philadelphia. So if Frank Rizzo had done that, he would be taken out and drawn and quartered. But Wilson Good did it. He was black, so it wasn't that bad.
It's interesting that the destruction he wreaked upon, the MOVE operation, I think what it was, is similar to the size of the Most Blessed Sacrament Parish.
Right. Yeah, there was probably some symbolism there. Yeah. But I'm sure unintentional.
Yeah.
So Kroll was completely oblivious to what was going on. He could not conceive of this because he had some type of official position. So he would tell me stories like his idea of the biography, I think, was telling me stories about how he would play golf with Bob Hope at Palm Springs in the Palm Springs Desert Classic. Now, if you're friends with Bob Hope, I mean, you're pretty well fixed, And how could somebody who was been friends with Bob Hope be the victim of some type of quasi-government attack on the Catholic Church? How is that possible? Well, that's what came out as part of doing the Kroll biography. Yes, it did happen. And he didn't know it was happening. And so he was this off in never-never land in one way or another because of his, I hate to say this, but because of his Americanism.
Yeah, you describe Kroll as an excellent administrator, good at raising funds. He put the diocese in the black, which is great. He set up internal funding, didn't have to rely on the banks and these things. So he set up the administration of the diocese very well. But he was your typical, what they call, brick and mortar man, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
He was the classic brick and mortar man. So he was. So you're the brick and mortar man during a cultural revolution. Well, you know. So in other words, you showed up at a gunfight with a knife, and that's kind of the story of his life as Cardinal Archbishop of Philadelphia. He was out of his depth when it came to the Cultural Revolution, completely out of his depth.
As were most.
I suppose if they're all brick and mortar guys, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, if they weren't cheering on the, you know, they're like the Indians who are, you know, cheering when the cavalry comes in and slaughters all the Indians, you know?
Now, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I mean, I tried to portray that they were aware that there was a very definite fifth column in the Catholic Church at that time. He and Bill Ball, who was his lieutenant, who was head of the Pennsylvania Catholic Conference. There were certain people they knew. We can't share information with these people because it goes immediately to our opponents in the culture wars.
And this would be like the National Catholic Welfare Conference, the Catholic Interracial Council, and also many, theologians that were becoming well known at the time, like Michael Novak, right?
Yes, yes, mm-hmm. They were all agents of the other side, and so across the board. So, for example, the bishops thought they controlled Catholic U, but then there was an insurrection there, and there were all these people working for the other side. There were double agents. There were lawyers who were sharing information with Leo Pfeffer. The church was involved in litigation over school funding. Leo Pfeffer was the Jewish lawyer who hated the Catholic Church. And Common Wheel, the liberal Catholic magazine, did us all a service by publishing one of Leo Pfeffer's memoirs, in which he said how much he hated the Catholics. You know, he would live in New York, and when he'd drive by a Catholic school and see those kids in those school uniforms, he felt physically ill at those kids, those girls with their Catholic school uniforms and those kids with their white shirts and ties. And he was the opponent in Lemon versus Kurtzman. And what the other one was Tillman versus Richardson, the two Catholic school education bills, Supreme Court decisions. He was also the litigator in the Shemp versus Abington, which was the school prayer decision. So the Jews at this point were coming into their own as litigators and disassembling the social order brick by brick.
It's a book about John Cardinal Kroll on the Cultural Revolution, but the prologue actually begins with a story about Leo Pfeffer giving a speech, talking about he's boasting of the victory of secular humanism over in the Enlightenment over the Catholic Church.
That was a euphemism too, because what do you mean by secular humanists? You mean Jews, don't you, Leo? You were an agent of the American Jewish Committee. That's who you were working for. So even he was being a little disingenuous at this point by talking about it was ethnic warfare. And I've told you before on this program, there are three ethnic groups in America, and they're based on three religions, and it's Protestants, Catholics, and Jews. That's the triple melting pot. That's the ethnic reality in America, and that's what was going on in Philadelphia. The Protestants and the Jews had allied themselves against the Catholics, who were the big and up-and-coming power, largely for demographic reasons at this time in the history of Philadelphia.
And it pretty much the battle lines were set. It was Leo Pfeffer versus Cardinal Kroll, because Cardinal Kroll had spearheaded spearheaded the effort to get public funding for Catholic schools, private schools in Pennsylvania, and of course there was. This case, it was Lemon versus Kurtzman, which put the kibosh on that,
right?
Under the guise of religious freedom, the First Amendment, and these things. And Leo Pfeffer is sort of credited with through litigation creating what they call the naked public square. But that's disingenuous, because the naked public square, it's a vacuum, and nature abhors a vacuum, and it fills that vacuum is the values and ideas of secular humanism, right? I mean, it's not like it. It's a question of whose values are going to prevail. And he set up a situation where, and this is part of Americanism, the flaw in the American system, perhaps, is the idea that somehow Catholics weren't allowed to impose their values. They're not supposed to do it. But however, if you're a secular humanist, you're a liberal, or you're Jewish, your values are considered de facto the norm. It's the Catholics who are imposing their values.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. So it's a colossal double standard, and the church was simply incapable of fighting it effectively, largely because of the mass defection of the Catholic intellectual elite during this period of time. Michael Novak is a good example of what I'm talking about. Charles Curran, better example. But Charles Curran is just the tip of a very large iceberg of basically Catholic priests who had simply abandoned the faith. Dan McGuire led the revolution at Catholic U, and he was a clergyman from Philadelphia. He wasn't a Jesuit, even though he's always identified as a Jesuit. And he spearheaded the revolution on Catholic University campus and then left and got married a nun, and then became a professor at Marquette University, where he would become a shill for the abortion industry in the 1980s. So the church was riddled with people like this,
And the temptation here is social mobility, sort of these lace curtain Catholics, I guess is the term they use. The idea they
lace curtain Irish.
lace curtain Irish is the term, I think. Yeah, lace curtain. But the idea is that there's an inferiority complex. At the same time, there's longing to have a place at the table of the, of America's Masonic feast, I guess you could say. And the social mobility is what lures them, because they want acceptance from Time Life and Rockefeller. Of course, all the money that comes with this as well. So
right.
Yeah.
Right. The classic example of this was Father Theodore Hesburgh, the president of Notre Dame. Massive Catholic inferiority complex. And it could only be calmed down, assuaged by association with the Rockefeller family. And the Rockefeller family was only too happy to oblige, because their crusade at this point was basically to destroy the church's teaching on contraception. And I am the first guy to document the secret conferences that got held at Notre Dame from 1962 to 1965 to undermine the church's teaching on contraception.
This is the Land O'Lakes conference.
No, this preceded the Land O'Lakes by 5 years.
Oh, that's right. That's right. There was that secret conference. Right. I'm thinking Land O'Lakes. Land O'Lakes is 67, right?
It was 62 to 65.
Yeah, so the crucial, during Vatican II.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly during Vatican II. Corresponded exactly to Vatican II. And Vatican II, I looked at the archives. I went to the Rockefeller archives and saw the correspondence, mainly from Cass Canfield, saying we have a window of opportunity now. The Second Vatican Council, everything is up for grabs. Let's change the church's teaching on contraception. Let's sponsor this conference at Notre Dame. And that's what they did.
And this is the one where they meticulously went through the list and excluded anyone who would take the traditional church position on these issues.
Right, right. Only liberals were invited. And so Hesburgh later wins an award on academic freedom, while during this time he is completely slavishly following the instructions of the Rockefeller Foundation to the T. They said, okay, you can't invite this guy. You have to invite this guy. These are the books that are on the table, and this is what the outcome is supposed to be. And he said, yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Well, you can't bow to a dictator in Rome, but you can you have to bow to John D. Rockefeller III, I suppose.
That's right. So that's the whole hypocrisy about Hesburgh and academic freedom. It was completely hypocritical, completely phony. And I brought this up, much to their chagrin, I think, at the 50th anniversary celebration of Land O'Lakes at Notre Dame, which was held this past fall, where John McGreevy tried to give the official narrative, Notre Dame narrative about what happened, what Land O'Lakes was, and he said it was a response to Vatican II. This is not true. It's not true. Vatican II ended in 1965. The real prelude to Land O'Lakes, which is basically how Hesburgh stole the University of Notre Dame from the Catholic Church and put it under a lay board of trustees, which Cardinal Kroll explicitly said to me was alienation of church property. He told me that in person when I asked him about it. In other words, theft. The real story is it happened over the spring of 1967. Now, this is the period when Kroll is on the board of trustees of Catholic University, and they're hearing all kinds of stories about a moral theologian by the name of Charles Curran, who is basically undermining the church's teaching in every class he teaches at Catholic University, which is run by the Catholic bishops of the United States. And so the bishops get together, they hold a meeting, and suddenly they realize, wait a minute, Curran doesn't have tenure. Oh, well, this is easy. We'll just let his contract expire. This is what Kroll told me. This is what was going back in the correspondence. And so the end of the semester comes and say, sorry, Father, we're not renewing your contract. Nice knowing you. We'll see you later. Well, this was the key for the revolution. Dan McGuire orchestrated a huge strike on campus. And at this point, the bishops backed down. Not only did they rehire Curran, they gave him tenure. And this was done behind Kroll's back. Kroll didn't know about it until he read it in the newspapers. And at this point, he should have held a press conference saying, I'm not going to go along with this. But he didn't, because he was a man who went along with the other bishops. And so what happened at this point is that Hesburgh saw his moment of opportunity. If the bishops can't control Catholic U, which is their own university, they're sure as hell not going to be able to control Notre Dame. And so he saw his moment and he stole Notre Dame from the Catholic Church over the summer of 1967.
And of course, this sets the stage for what happens, you know, at Catholic University, because while legally the bishops were correct, morally they correct, the media's coverage of it, you know, was very favorable to Father Curran, and that's and they backed down. They didn't understand the political ramifications or how it would be covered in the press, and they thought it'd be a simple matter of just not renewing his contract. But you had sort of this, you know, this Soros-style revolt being right. planned on Catholic U, and look spontaneous. Of course, this is the era of the 1960s, and they're sort of falling into line with what's going on in the universities across the country in regards to, you know, the Vietnam War and these things. So it's all part of the spirit of the age, and of course the media will play it up, and then they blinked. You're right, and then I think he was able to teach here for another 20 years. I think right was it 20 years?
Yeah, and then it was basically. The man I mentioned, Monsignor Herring, this guy who got him fired eventually after some years.
Because I remember, when I was in high school reading about, you know, Father Curran in the 80s. And it's amazing how long that, you know, that he persisted there.
He persisted with impunity.
Yeah. And, of course, at Notre Dame and also Catholic U, with the this is also an attempt in order to get a hold of Rockefeller money, I suppose, and also federal funding, right? Because the Tilton decision finds federal funds going to Catholic universities constitutional because they declare them secular in purpose.
Hesburgh was a crucial figure in the Tilton decision. So Lemon versus Kurtzman said basically the government can't give financial aid to Catholic grade schools because they are religious in purpose. And then Tilton versus Richardson came along and said, but the government can give financial aid to Catholic universities because they are secular in purpose. And it was Hesburgh that orchestrated this largely through the alienation of church property and by putting Notre Dame under a lay board of trustees. That paved the way for basically the secular understanding of Catholic higher education.
Now, the broader issue of the culture war, this wasn't something that was necessarily spontaneous or just a confluence of events, certain social, political currents coming together to create this situation. You cite the importance of foundations in sort of fomenting this situation and directing the culture, and how this is an assault ultimately on self-government and constitutional government. If I may, I'm going to quote from your book here, because I think you provide a wonderful summation of how foundations are sort of shadow governments in our society.
Yeah.
And you cite Rene Worms or his book with Foundations and Their Power, his book about the Rees Committee hearings. But here, I'll read from it here. Rene Worms, or Rees's legal assistant throughout the hearings, documented in a book published in 1957 not only the dangers posed by foundations to the institutions of the Republic, but also the influence those foundations and their political allies were bringing to bear on the nation's cultural institutions. The great foundations, Ford, Rockefeller, Carnegie, were for the most part founded as a result of the New Deal and as an attempt to prevent the flow of family money into the coffers of the federal government under the tax policies instituted by Roosevelt. Created from the wealth of this country's major capitalists, the foundations soon applied the techniques of the cartel and the trust to the flow of information and the reconfiguration of culture. The foundations would put up money, which would serve as venture capital in the politics of change. Foundations like those run by the Rockefeller brothers would fund projects like Kinsey sex surveys, which would have been otherwise impossible to support given the constraints of democratically elected government or the simple satisfying of market forces. Foundations would fund research which they found congenial, and this almost invariably involved instigating social change away from a position of congruity with the moral law. They involved, more often than not, as the Kinsey studies did, the substitution of scientific data for moral principle, and then when the project had received a modicum of public acceptance, foundations would turn the funding of the projects over to the government. This was by and large the mechanisms of cultural revolution in this country. The foundations would fund the undermining of some law, generally having to do with sex, the family, the morals or religion, the courts would remove any legal roadblocks, and the press would proselytize for whatever the social change entailed. Given widespread dissemination to the scientific surveys, which the foundations funded, and eventually the government would set up programs based on what the foundations proposed, funded by government money. Government's involvement in contraception is one instance of this general rule that we will examine in greater detail later. Dr. Jones, that is a wonderful, wonderful summation of how foundations work and their importance in our society. So I want to congratulate on that.
Thank you.
But
I found myself admiring the prose as you were reading it.
Yes, I've shared it with many people. Now, this is very important because this is something that, like, Kroll and the other bishops and other Catholics and other conservatives aren't recognizing at this point. And many still don't. Is the malevolence that's going on in the culture war itself, because culture war, we tend to think of it as left versus right. Now, the left likes to pretend that it doesn't exist because they want it. But the right tends to see it as sort of a Democrat thing, a leftist thing. But it isn't right. It isn't really a left and right thing, is it?
No, it's ethnic. It's ethnic, which means religious as well,
mm-hmm.
because that's the armature of cultural conflict in America. So to give you just one example here, I went to the Rockefeller archives and discovered that Hesburgh had arranged a private meeting between John D. Rockefeller III and Pope Paul VI, at which meeting Rockefeller volunteered to write the Pope's birth control encyclical for. Now, I'm the first guy to discover this. It came out first in John Cardinal Kroll and the Cultural Revolution. And so I find myself in Cincinnati, and I'm talking to the chairman of the history department at the University of Xavier University, Catholic University. And I tell him this story, and he says, "This can't be true." I said, "What do you mean it can't be true?" He said, "Well, if it were true, someone important would have said it." So I said, "Well, are you trying to tell me I'm not important?" I said, "My wife thinks I'm important. My children think I'm important. Why don't you think I'm important?" In other words, what you're telling me here is you have no capacity to do independent historical research. You don't even know what it is. This is a primary document in an archive that exists for this type of research, and you can't accept it because some big, powerful figure hasn't told you that it's okay to accept it. This shows you the pathetic state of Catholic scholarship in the United States of America.
Well, if the New York Times doesn't report it, it didn't happen, right?
So. It doesn't happen. And so somebody has to come and tell this poor Catholic guy, it's okay, you can say it now. It was unbelievable. It was unbelievable.
And under the sort of the liberal regime that we live under, Catholic ethnics are even denied the grammar to defend their ethnicity, their same way they're denied the grammar to defend their neighborhoods at this critical moment, because really to defend the integrity of the ethnic neighborhood you'd be called a racist, right?
Well, that's why, because they were denied their Catholic identity.
Mm-hmm.
So that when Martin Luther King showed up in Marquette Park in Chicago in 1966, it was white people throwing those rocks and bottles at him. Well, those white people all happened to be Lithuanians, Lithuanian Catholics, but they were denied that identity because you wanted to shoehorn them into the racial narrative that was the dominant narrative in American politics. So once they're identified as white, the next step is obviously they're racist. And why else would they be throwing rocks and bottles at a saint like Martin Luther King?
Mm-hmm.
So the whole drama is already written there. It's just that it doesn't make it. It's not true. That's not what really happened. And that story is in many ways the tragedy of the American Catholic Church, is that they were deprived. It was identity theft. Let's be honest here. It was identity theft. They were calling all these Catholics white guys, and that was a form of identity theft.
And this ethnicity is very important because you cite Mullen, who emerges from this Blessed Sacrament parish, this geographically small area, but very dense, a strong sense of identity, Catholic identity, Irish Catholic identity. They identify with the parish, and because of this, he's able to flex political muscle and hold back the tide. And yeah, and this enrages the establishment in the same way that I think, remember a while back, I interviewed you about your book regarding Mara Lansky and the Cincinnati Ballet, and how Newport, Kentucky, one of the reasons why it was cleaned out was this Catholic sheriff that had caught the attention of both Bobby and John F. Kennedy because they knew him from Notre Dame.
Right.
And so, again, Catholic identity has political ramifications, or at least the Catholicism somewhat, whether it's ethnic, conforms how they act politically. And this is what's driving, the Protestants and the Jews nuts, because only they are allowed to identify with their ethnicity and then enact those, values politically, because they're the establishment, I suppose. That account of John D. Rockefeller III, meeting the Pope is very funny in your book. Where is it here? Here we go. Do you mind if I read from it?
No, go ahead.
Because I think I won't be able to do it justice trying to do a synopsis of it. You gave the background, so I'll start here. The church's failure to make what Rockefeller considered a positive statement could hardly be ascribed to lack of zeal on Rockefeller's part. Within the minutes of a July 1965 meeting with the Pope, Rockefeller was reproaching himself out loud for not expressing his case forcefully enough. In an attempt to calm him down, Monsignor Paul Marcinkus, later head of the Vatican Bank, suggested that J.D.R. III write the Pope a letter expressing any points which might not have been made during the meeting. A day later, on July 16, 1965, J.D.R. III duly sent off a letter on the importance of the population problem and the role that the church might assume in its solution. The incident reads like a chapter out of an unpublished Henry James novel. The earnest American Protestant with his two newly invented contraceptives and a boundless faith that technology and progress will solve all the world's ills confronts the head of the old world seminal institution, an Italian gentleman by the name of Montini. There is no problem more important facing mankind today, Rockefeller informed the Pope earnestly. The Pope fails to heed Rockefeller's advice, we will face disaster on unprecedented magnitude. Mr. Rockefeller then explains his invention to the Pope, I can just see him doing this, calling the IUD a breakthrough of truly major proportions, making available a method which is safe, effective, inexpensive, feasible under the most difficult living conditions. Experience with its use to date indicates that it will prove highly acceptable to great masses of people everywhere. The IUD, as we have already indicated, was driven off the market in the United States within a matter of years as a result of product liability lawsuits. Those who claim that the Church missed a historic opportunity by issuing Humanae Vitae would do well to ponder the consequences for papal credibility, much less infallibility, if Paul VI had taken Rockefeller's advice and endorsed the IUD as a means of Catholic-approved birth control. When it came to giving advice, JDR III was used to undivided attention of religious leaders who seemed to benefit financially in direct proportion to how avidly they implemented his agenda through agencies of their denominations. The Quakers, whose idea of missionary work included installing IUDs in Mexican women, are a good example. It was perhaps the accommodating nature of the mainline Protestants which JDR III to dispense with niceties and get blunt with the Pope and pointing out to His Holiness what might have happened if the Pope failed to see things his way. I'll skip ahead here. It says, one wonders what was going through the Pope's mind as he read these lines. He wrote a letter to the Pope, you know, making his point again. Was he supposed to feel a sense of gratitude at being saved, along with his church, from being swept aside by the flooding tide of progress in history? Or was it something more like an Italian version of, if you're so damn rich, why aren't you smart? Either way, history shows that the Pope passed on J.D. III's suggestion. So, sorry for the long quote, but I thought it was worth it.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, here he is, again, Rockefeller III is he's pushing this agenda very hard. Of course, he's disappointed, I guess, when in 1968 the Pope issues Humanae Vitae. And this just drives the liberals crazy, because I guess at this time they thought the church was liberalizing, and that this brought a certain thawing of relations between the church and modern liberalism. But as you quote Leo Pfeffer, his problem with the church and the problem that the establishment had with the church was, when it was strong, it was a problem, but when it was weak, they had no problem with it.
Right, right. And that's the story. It's gotten weaker ever since. The turning point was the end of Vatican II. The Jews broke the production code in 1965. Griswold versus Connecticut was passed in 1965. The Supreme Court decision striking down the illegality of the sale of contraceptives. And the church hasn't won a single cultural battle since that time.
It's interesting that these victories, at least in America, are largely through the courts and through the bureaucracy, correct?
Right, right. No, this is in distinction with places like Ireland and Australia, which show their colonial nature by approving by referendum the things that had to be imposed on us by Supreme Court Eucharist.
Mm-hmm. Now, you bring up Ireland. They just had their referendum, and apparently they overturned their Eighth Amendment, the Human Life Amendment that exists in Ireland. I think it was passed in the 80s.
Yes.
So here we have Catholic Ireland entering into, I guess, the Dark Ages, the modern world.
Choosing their chains.
Yes.
Choosing to put on their chains, the chains of slavery. They've already, Ireland has approved a bailout for the crooked banks, which they should not have done. So now they have a usurious burden placed on their economy. And then they go ahead and march even farther into occupied territory, approving gay marriage, approving now abortion. This is a war, a hatred of the Catholic Church, expressed by the people of Ireland themselves, the Catholic Church being the institution that saved them, preserved them in existence during the centuries of British oppression. So it's a tragedy.
Now Ireland went for what was called the Irish Tiger in the 90s and the economic boom. And it seems like it was at this point that the Irish began to worship mammon. And this is an important process, because it seems like they've gone through this process that you've lined out with Michel Foucault, right?
Yes. Basically, there's an arm aber sexy, as the mayor of Berlin said. We're poor but we're sexy. So you can go to the gay disco instead of asking for a raise. If you give us unlimited sexual liberation, we won't criticize your economic system. That's Michel Foucault's pact with the devil, and the Irish have gone along with it. There's a tragedy here, okay? Let me get to the heart of the tragedy, okay? I finished the book, and I get a call from the Cardinal Kroll's new secretary. This is not the man that was his secretary when I began the book. This man calls and tells me, after I submitted the manuscript to them, he says, His Eminence has not read the book, and His Eminence cannot read the book, which is basically his saying to me that Cardinal Kroll was non compos mentis at that point. He had had problems with his liver, and it was clouding his brain, and so he couldn't read it. But then he said, but I have prepared summaries of it, and I have explained it to His Eminence. At this point, I started to get a funny feeling. And then my funny feeling started to get worse when he says, be sure to let me know as soon as you get a publisher. And I thought, this doesn't sound good. this doesn't sound good. And so I became the publisher. It was one of the first books that Fidelity Press published. And we announced the publication, and then lo and behold, I get a letter from the biggest law firm in Philadelphia announcing that His Eminence Cardinal Kroll is going to sue me. So now I have to contact a lawyer, and I contact the lawyer, and his lawyer calls up, my lawyer calls up his lawyer and says to his lawyer, your client is going to sue my client. What is the basis for this suit? And Kroll's lawyer says, there is no basis for this suit. My client is going to ruin your client financially. That's the plan. And so my lawyer says, would you mind putting that in writing? Well, of course, he's not going to put that in writing. So at this point, I am faced with the sword of Damocles is hanging over my head. I have arranged for a press conference to be held in Philadelphia announcing the book, and the Archdiocese has made it clear to me that if I go ahead with this, they will file a lawsuit with the biggest firm in Philadelphia. And the financial resources of the Archdiocese of Philadelphia, which are considerable, will be up against my financial resources, which are non-existent. So as I said, I'm sitting there waiting for the sword of Damocles to fall on my neck, and I get a phone call. And it's Bill Ball, who is the, in many ways, the second major character in that book, and in many ways, in my sense, the hero of the book. And he said, I read the manuscript, and he said, it's the best account I've ever read of what happened during the 60s. So I said, Bill, I'm glad to hear that. It gratifies me to hear you say that. Now let me tell you my story. And then I told him what Kroll was intending to do to me. And he said to me, I'm going to make some phone calls. That's the last I ever heard of Bill Ball. He died shortly after that. But I went and held the press conference, and there was no lawsuit. So I faced him down and basically beat him. But in a sense, he won because he collaborated with the Philadelphia Inquirer, the enemy of the Catholic Church, in writing an article about me, which basically attacked, just called me the hick from Indiana. That's pretty much the gist of it, even though I'd grown up in Philadelphia. I held the press conference in the middle of the Schuylkill Expressway in front of a high-rise project building, apartment building, and I said, this is a monument to a failed experiment, and they're going to blow it up, tear it down. And then the reporter immediately said, no, we have the head of the Philadelphia Housing Authority here in the car right here, and she said that's not going to happen. I said, okay, that's what they told me. But, you know, what can I say? Why is she here? Why doesn't she have more important things to do than sit here and be in this car? Anyways, 6 weeks, the article came out. It was basically Hick from Indiana doesn't know what he's talking about. And then 6 weeks later, they blew up the building. So the tragedy here is that there was a moment where where I could have joined forces, my research, my scholarship, which no one else was able to do, could have joined forces with the Archdiocese of Philadelphia, and we could have come out with an assessment of what really happened during the 1960s, and it would have led to, I think, a reform. But it didn't happen. The Archdiocese closed the archives. Okay, now, if what I said was false, why are you closing the archives? Let the other people in and prove where I made where I said things that were false. In the letter I sent to Cardinal Kroll, I said, If what I said is false, point out the error. If what I said is true, why do you strike me? Yes. You may remember someone else said that.
Yes.
And it happened to be Jesus Christ. And Cardinal Kroll knew that, and he died shortly thereafter. So he went to his grave and faced his maker as with one of his last acts, trying to destroy somebody who was trying to tell the truth. When people get in a situation like that, it's not that what you're saying is false that bothers them. It's what you're saying is true. That's what's bothering them. Because I, of all people, if it's false, I'm the first guy who wants to change it, obviously. You have the manuscript. Let's go through it and correct the errors. I don't want to publish something with errors in it. But that's not the problem. The problem is that what I said was true. And so as a result, there was a moment of opportunity that passed, and Philadelphia has suffered. The church has suffered in Philadelphia as a result of pedophile lawsuits. And I think the same thing happened in Ireland. I tried to explain what I knew about Ireland and how the same thing was happening there and was basically ignored. And so the price is what we see now in both places.
Yeah, I believe Bernard Law also spurned your was it Bernard Law who said, why do you want to ship?
That was another instance where I went up to him and gave him the article about the priest at Notre Dame who had been shot to death in the basement of his house, surrounded by automatic weapons and homosexual pornography and whips and chains. Mm-hmm. And so after reading, he says, what good does this do? Well, His Eminence had to beat it out of Boston in a hurry and go over to Rome, where he had political sanctuary, because they were going to arrest him. So I felt like saying, well, do you know now what good that would have done if you had taken action against those priests under your jurisdiction? But, you know, this is part of the tragedy of history.
Now, you make the point, and this is you've actually suggested, I believe it was in Chicago, where developed a plan using sort of this abandoned or idle church property.
That was for Philadelphia.
Was that Philadelphia? Okay. No.
I had MBS in mind.
Okay. MBS. This is a very interesting story there, because it shows you the problem, the thinking of those who run the church. But go ahead.
MBS was the biggest Catholic grade school in the world. And it was in the same city with Cardinal Doherty High School, which was the biggest Catholic high school in the world. And both of them are gone now. Both of them are in Philadelphia. Both of them are gone because of the war I'm describing in this book. And so as a result of that, I proposed something called the League of St. Benedict, where the church would make the MBS buildings five-story school, a five-story rectory, and a three-story convent. For 3,000 students and an army of nuns and priests, empty because of ethnic cleansing. And I said, put it to use by putting young Catholic families in there and you'll regenerate the parish. That's called the Benedict. I called it the League of St. Benedict. Nobody was interested. Nobody.
Well, because perhaps the oligarchs were offering more money for the property.
Well, that's we tried it in New York and they wanted, you know, the market value for rentals. They weren't interested. Why should I take these loser Catholic families when I can get full market value for this rental property in Brooklyn? What are you, crazy?
It's ebb and flow, man. That's what it is, man. It's just physics. It's not morality, right?
That's right.
Newton, right? It's like Isaac Newton's idea. Yeah. Newtonian physics and morality.
Story in Baron Metal, you know, economics and physics, pseudo-physics.
Mm-hmm. But that's an example of, and I think you made another point, is the importance, well, it emphasizes disunity within the church, and this is all part of breaking up these neighborhoods and the diaspora, the suburbia, and the culture war and these things. The disunity that highlights is a big problem. And you point out, like in places like in Poland, where there seems to be a strong ethnic Catholic identity, there seems to be on the rebound, or at least there seems to be a turnaround. At least they're able to identify the enemy, and the church reacts very differently in Poland than the American church does.
Right. When I was in Poland to do a book tour for the Polish translation of Libido Dominandi, the bishops were getting phone calls every 2 minutes to cancel my talk because Jones is an anti-Semite. And the bishops could have thrown me under the bus, but they did not. They allowed the tour to go forward. And as a result of our collaboration, we destroyed gay marriage in Poland. No gay marriage referendum in Poland. We destroyed it.
And the reason that's possible is because of ethno-religious identity.
And unity,
unity that comes from that.
But
the thing is, and that goes so against the grain of Americanism, which was supposed to be, it's supposed to be pluralistic. We're all supposed to be individuals. That's our identity in these things. And that's the weakness of the American system, the flaw in it, or the threat that it presents, perhaps, is a better way of looking at it.
What we now see after Trump is basically that democracy is a facade. To give the people the illusion they have some type of say, when the real say in this country is carried out through oligarchic institutions like the Supreme Court. It's been that way from the beginning, from Marbury versus Madison up to the present. That's all it's ever been. And now we have the consciousness of that, which, and that's what got Donald Trump elected. Now, he's turned out to be a disappointment, but that's what got him elected.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's also important to point this from the standpoint of just political science, is we can buy into the rhetoric of individual rights and liberty and paper constitutions. But in reality, if we don't have any corporate representation through things like, well, parishes and the church, ethnic-based organizations, these things, that's really what we need in order to really defend our rights against the oligarchs. And we're denied that in the name of liberalism, I guess.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. And that's part of the tragedy of what happened to the Catholic Church in the United States. They've internalized the commands of their oppressors. And the best place you can do that, if you want to spend $250,000, is Notre Dame University and places like that.
Yes. Yeah. Well, you know, well, Kroll himself, I guess you could say, sort of a tragic figure. He may not have been aware of it, but in his waning days, when he was trying to, you know, suppress your book, it's pride, perhaps. But during the time, he did seem to recognize the threat that Leo Pfeffer posed. Obviously, if you look at Leo Pfeffer's Naked Public Square, it's been an unmitigated disaster. And you cite that in the book. I think you write, the depletion of the religious and moral capital of our nation, Kroll argued, the progressive decline in morality led to a corresponding increase in crime and corruption, skyrocketing crime rates between 1960 and 1970. Philadelphia, I think the population of the nation grew 13%, but the crime rate grew to 176%, 120% in Philadelphia. So this was the culture war. This was the consequence of it, because the Naked Public Square means it's bereft of all morality, and you can't have a moral order. And nothing works without a moral order.
And you can't have a social order without a moral order.
Yeah.
Oh, and so the one of the casualties was the black family, because the government did get involved, and they were using the birth control pill as the continuation of Margaret Sanger's Negro Project. And you had plenty of Negro ministers lining up to put birth control clinics in their churches. And the result was the destruction of the black family.
Yeah, and you should, so we have
8%, or what is it, 80% illegitimacy rate in places
that, yeah,
in the south side of Chicago, where you have 700 murders a year. So
yeah,
violence,
yeah,
crime, and broken families.
And yes, you could say, roughly speaking, something like the Moynihan Report and the Catholic approach would be to promote morality, family cohesion, and these things. But the establishment wanted, I guess, depopulation and ethnic cleansing, right?
But Moynihan's proposal was to basically hire black men as mailmen, and then increase delivery to twice a day so you can hire a lot more people. And these black men would then go on to be able to support a family because they were earning a decent wage, so the mothers could stay home and raise the children. This was all against the plan of the oligarchs, the Jews and the WASP elite that ran places like Philadelphia. They didn't want any part of it. And so they got what they wanted, and the result was catastrophe for Philadelphia.
The secularizing activists, I guess.
Secularizing activists, to use. Here's Archbishop Chaput still doesn't get it. Still doesn't get it. The neocon Archbishop of Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm. Now, it's interesting. I think at the time of the Moynihan Report, the black illegitimacy rate was 25%.
Right.
I think now the white illegitimacy rate is close to 30%.
Right.
And the black illegitimacy rate, as you said, is close to 80%. So that's how far we've come.
Right.
Under this Naked Public Square advocated by Leo Pfeffer. And Leo Pfeffer, you know, he's said religion should play no role in politics, really.
Yeah, unless it's the Jewish secular religion, in which case that has the determinative role.
Yeah.
So complete hypocrisy.
Yeah.
Complete hypocrisy.
Well, Dr. Jones, anything else to say? I think we kind of covered the gist of the book.
I'm glad we talked about the book, because it was ahead of its time. I hate to say this, but it was ahead of its time. And the Archdiocese of Philadelphia, to its everlasting shame, tried to suppress the book. And it's the truth is great, and it will prevail. And so the book is back in print now.
The book is John Cardinal Kroll and the Culture Revolution by E. Michael Jones, back in print. I highly recommend it. It's a wonderful read, and it's particularly interesting given the fact that I read Slaughter Cities first. But I see how it led to this, and of course the other books as well, because they're all, it's all kind of one story, one long, very complex story. So I want to thank you for coming back on.
My pleasure. Always a pleasure to talk to you, Tim.
Yeah, as the editor, again, you're the editor of Culture Wars magazine, culturewars.com, where you can get a subscription there and also buy the books. So I will bid you a good night, and maybe we'll talk in the near future.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Good night, then.
Good night.
Bye-bye.